Today, who's in and who's out? It's Boris Johnson's new cabinet. And the punk, politics and pessimism in this year's list of Mercury Prize nominees. During the Conservative leadership campaign, Boris Johnson was asked a very simple question.
They asked him, what's your favourite scene from the movies? And he said it was the scene from The Godfather.
Michael Francis Ritchie, do you renounce Satan?
Where there was that mass retribution, killings all round town.
I do renounce him.
But it was a mafia sort of bloodletting. Little did we know that that was actually a clue to the reshuffle to come, where he has wielded the knife with great ruthlessness.
Are you feeling pretty happy?
Wednesday's cabinet reshuffle was one of the most dramatic in modern political history. By the end of the evening, 17 cabinet ministers, many former Remainers, had been replaced by mostly hard-right Johnson loyalists. As the Shadow Chancellor put it,
this is the most right-wing cabinet in my lifetime. Even Mrs. Thatcher had a number of what she called...
Is that true? A lot of right-wingers are absolutely popping the champagne corks tonight.
Because Prime Minister Johnson's message is clear. This is a cabinet built to get Brexit done. From The Guardian, I'm India Rackerson. Today in Focus, Boris Johnson has his Vote Leave cabinet. But who's in it and what's going to happen next? Jonathan, what is the point of a cabinet reshuffle?
It's the swiftest and most complete way for a new prime minister to put their stamp on their government.
Jonathan Friedland is a Guardian columnist.
It's a blood transfusion of politics. It's a way of saying, here's fresh blood. Officially, the mandate remains the same, so it's the same body, but with new blood circulating around the system. And usually it is just three or four faces at the top table, sometimes seven or eight, but this is an absolutely sweeping reshuffle. In effect, he has remade a new government.
David Gawk has resigned. Mr. Clark at the Business Department has resigned. Liam Fox, lifelong Brexiteer, he's gone at the Department of International Trade.
I don't think there's ever been as sweeping a restructuring where the new faces vastly outnumber the ones who've stayed on.
That takes you up to 11 out of 22 new faces in the cabinet.
What did you make of it as the kind of news kept rolling over Wednesday night?
Well, it's impressive, first of all, of Boris Johnson. Take away the view of whether you like it or not, and this is no element of approval. Just as a political operator, there is impressively ruthless efficiency in this reshuffle. So that was just on one side. Once you get into the actual content, ideologically, this is an extremely right-wing, hard-right cabinet, particularly at the top table. And so you look at some of those faces, that is a new complexion.
Tell me what happened then on Wednesday. What was the government he ditched? What is the government that he's formed?
Well, he inherited a government which had been pivoted and balanced on the key question of our politics, which is Brexit. Theresa May wanted a team of rivals approach, which was the phrase Abraham Lincoln used about his cabinet in the middle of the 19th century, that he wanted people on both sides of the big debate at the time. And Theresa May did that by giving the really top Brexit jobs to Brexiters. She appointed one Boris Johnson to Foreign Secretary. So she wanted to be able to say to the Conservative Party, look, all of you are represented. This is a broad church.
Right, very different.
Boris Johnson has done the opposite of that.
Well, good morning, everybody. And it is wonderful to see this new team assembled here.
He has said this is a Brexit cabinet, and not only a Brexit cabinet, it's a no-deal Brexit cabinet.
We are now committed, all of us, to leaving the European Union on October the 31st, or indeed earlier.
In fact, the way I described it when writing about it for the paper was to say this is a vote leave cabinet and a vote leave government that he's put in. Now, some of the pushback on that has been, no, there's 13 or 15 people who voted remain in the referendum. That's not the point. The point is people who have come around to the acceptability of a no-deal crash out from the European Union. So even someone like Amber Rudd, who was such a Remainer that she debated on TV against Boris Johnson as the lead voice of Remain, famously said.
And from Boris, well, he's the life and soul of the party. But he's not the man you want driving you home at the end of the evening.
She's now in the cabinet, keeping her job as work and pension secretary. But she's done that. The price for that was to say, yeah, I can live with no deal. And all the ones who couldn't are out. So Philip Hammond or David Gawke and even other leavers have been booted out. And that's, to me, that was the mark of when I thought we really are dealing with a sort of Don Corleone approach to this. Penny Mordaunt, who is a leaver, out from defence, and Liam Fox, famously a leaver from international trade, given the boot because they had backed Jeremy Hunt, as if personal loyalty is crucial to the kind of mafia boss who is at the top of this tree.
And of course, Dominic Cummings, who was the former director of Vote Leave, this sort of has a sense of his fingerprints all over it.
Yes, the former director of Vote Leave, famously depicted by Benedict Cumberbatch in that Brexit TV movie.
Then I will get us across the line in whatever way I can. But in order to do that, we have to restack the odds in our favour. We have to hack the political system.
Hack it.
Like a cyber hack. Get in through the back door.
Now installed as effectively the right-hand man for Boris Johnson inside Number 10. And ruthlessness is his trademark. I mean, brutally so, to the point where he eventually actually had to be bundled out of government when he worked for Michael Gove because he was so rude and aggressive to Michael Gove's colleagues. So he is somebody who makes a lot of enemies, but this does seem to bear his fingerprints. A reshuffle that was clearly planned. And as I said, the execution of it is very striking. But Cummings' own appointment is important because it says this is what prompted me partly to say this is a Vote Leave cabinet. There he is, the director of Vote Leave, with more or less the top job at the right hand of the new prime minister.
It'd be good to take a closer look at some of the members of the new government and to start with Priti Patel.
I'm excited for change because we as Conservatives in government, we've got a great opportunity, actually.
She was a key member of Vote Leave and has landed one of the biggest jobs as Home Secretary. And she is notoriously pretty right-wing. What do we know about her political past?
She is very right-wing. She was a very early leaver. People have paid a lot of attention to the fact that in 2011 she expressed support for restoring the death penalty.
I would actually support the reintroduction of capital punishment to serve as a deterrent because I do think we do not have enough deterrence in this country.
Oh, she did later say that she doesn't agree with it anymore.
She said that she's changed her view of that,
but
I think it tells you something of the person. This wasn't something she said in 1981 or 1991 or 2001. 2011, okay. So it's not as if she was, you know, a young crazy kid of 40 or whatever. She was, it's not that long ago. So that gives you some sense. But she is absolutely the, you know, one of those politicians who will be always two steps to the right of whoever else is speaking. So she is hawkish on Europe and was one of those people who was, again, a Vote Leave veteran. I mean, she was at the rallies and on the bus. The other thing is she obviously had to be forced out of government under Theresa May for going rogue and conducting her own one-person diplomatic operation.
She was forced to apologise on Monday after holding 12 secret meetings with Israeli officials, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
And there have been question marks raised about her role lobbying as a lobbyist before entering government and as if continuing that role, her relationships with various lobbying firms in government is what led to her departure last time. And what's significant is that that has not mattered in the same way that the appointment of, say, Dominic Cummings as senior advisor, he was found to be in contempt of Parliament for refusing to appear before MPs' committees. Gavin Williamson, not long ago, booted out as Defence Secretary because the Cabinet Secretary pointed the finger of blame at him for being a leaker, causing damage and risking national security.
He is out. So a Defence Secretary has lost his job over accusations of leaks of security information in 2019. Our politics truly is stranger than fiction.
He's back around the Cabinet table. So there is a thread running through here which says, you know, no matter what violations or offences you've committed, Boris Johnson is wiping the slate clean.
So when Priti Patel was forced to step down in 2017, what's she been doing that now merits her a position in Boris Johnson's cabinet?
She's been a backbencher. She's been a staunch Brexiter. I think she's back there because all through his appointments, Boris Johnson is looking to make totemic appointments that signal to those on the right of his party who previously blocked Theresa May, but also outside the party, and I'm thinking here of the Brexit Party, that he plans to be as Brexity as Brexit can be. He wants iconic faces. If you're a kind of, you know, Brexit fanatic, these are the people whose faces you have on posters on your wall, and he's got them now on his side, and I think he's all about sucking the oxygen out of Nigel Farage's Brexit Party.
And you could say exactly the same thing about Dominic Raab, who was the former Brexit Secretary, a firm Brexiteer, and he takes the role of Foreign Secretary. I mean, that is a job that requires a lot of artful diplomacy. Is he up to it?
No, I would say not. Although one thing that's interesting is that he was more diligent in the job and hardworking. He only did it for a short while, really, than his predecessor, David Davis. But the key thing about him, again, is he's known as a kind of Brexit head case. I mean, he's a headbanger on Brexit. He was the guy who first raised this issue of proroguing, suspending, dissolving Parliament so that MPs wouldn't have a say and couldn't stand and block no deal.
Are you really saying that you would go to the Queen and ask her to prorogue Parliament, dragging her into politics in a way that she's avoided for 70 years.
I won't be
years.
Dragging anyone anywhere. But I think the signal that we send to the EU is crucially important. And we've frankly made too many mistakes stumbling in these negotiations by ruling things out.
So it's a virility gesture. You put in Dominic Raab as Foreign Secretary and First Secretary of State, which is this glorified title of, you know, in effect, Deputy Prime Minister. He's signalling to those people who last time gave Theresa May such difficulty, I am one of yours. And I think he's all about seeing if he can get some of the hardcore Brexiters to come over to his side this time.
It's a pretty important job, though, Foreign Secretary. I mean, we're in the middle of escalating tensions with Iran. And he's just a sort of poster boy for Brexit.
Well, I mean, it's not as if Boris Johnson thinks he's incompetent. I just think that he's not thinking you're going to be the man to negotiate Brexit. I mean, there will be those other things to do. But it was interesting, wasn't it, in Boris Johnson's speech on the steps of Downing Street, he talked about Brexit a lot and then he went straight into a domestic agenda. There was nothing else about the world in it.
And we're going to fulfil the repeated promises of Parliament to the people and come out of the EU on October the 31st, no ifs or buts.
Right, and then the top job, Chancellor. Sajid Javid, former business secretary and most recently Home Secretary. Has he had his eye on this job for a while?
Yes. In fact, I would guess that probably when he entered politics, this was the job he was aiming for.
I got into politics because, you know, I love my country and I want to give people more opportunities than I had.
Because he is an ex-banker, a high-rolling figure in finance. And his allies have been saying there is no one in Parliament, let alone in government, who knows as much about money and the economy as him. I think that's a bit of spin, but he was very successful in his career in the city. And in a way, his leadership bid was, in some ways, a job application to be Chancellor. His appointment is fascinating because he's the one person who bucks that trend that I've been describing. You can't say this is Sajid Javid's point proves that it's the vote leave cabinet. He is the exception to the rule in the sense that he was a Remainer and he was somebody around that table who did side in the Theresa May era with Philip Hammond and others in advising against no deal. My reading of that is that he is so keen to be Chancellor that he has made his peace with no deal because that was the price of the job. He is a bit like Amber Rudd in that situation. These are people who have absolutely sold out their principles for the sake of the job, and I think he wouldn't have done it, Sajid Javid, if it was any other job than being Chancellor.
How do you think then that he's going to manage the purse strings and deliver on some of the pledges that Boris Johnson has made?
And so I am announcing now on the steps of Downing Street that we will fix the crisis in social care once and for all with a clear plan we have prepared. 20 new hospital upgrades, and we're going to come in with another 20,000 police on the streets, and we start recruiting forthwith.
Well, it's difficult because Boris Johnson just was spraying money around as Boris Johnson would put it, he was spaffing money up the wall.
£60 million I saw was being spaffed up the wall.
To use a Johnsonism that he used in a different context, not a phrase I would use myself, but there we are. He was promising huge spends. I mean, recruiting 20,000 police officers doesn't come cheap. And the money, the sums really don't add up. And somebody like Sajid Javid, who in the old Thatcherite language is fiscally dry, you know, he was an austerian, believer in austerity, and believes in tight money and small state. He will have to go against those instincts as well as his instincts on Brexit, because this is just releasing the cash. Boris Johnson wants that because he knows that there are whole parts of the country that will not vote for his party unless there is an end to austerity. And he likes being the sunshine candidate, and his instructions to his chancellor will be very clear, which is spend, spend, spend.
His new cabinet really is really good fodder, and I'm sure we could chew over it for days. But it'd be good just to talk about a few more of the roles, particularly Gove, because he's been given this role, Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, but he wasn't given the role of First Secretary of State. Do you think he's feeling a bit hard done by?
Probably, actually. He might be smarting at that, although he'll be thinking, you know, lucky I'm not sacked. The interesting thing about the job is that he will be, obviously the Duchy of Lancaster is a sort of honorific title. It is to be sit in the Cabinet Office as the Prime Minister's enforcer. And there is an interesting recognition by Boris Johnson of his own limitations, because he isn't a detail man. And by common consent, again, not a left-right thing, this isn't an approving or disapproving thing, but people in Whitehall do regard Michael Gove as a very capable minister. He is somebody who knows how to use the Whitehall machine, which is exactly why Boris Johnson's put him in that job. He wants his writ to run through Whitehall. He wants Gove to be able to patrol around Whitehall, chasing up particularly no-deal preparations. The other appointment that I thought was interesting was that of Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Newly promoted by Boris Johnson to be leader of the House of Commons. We have rarely seen an overhaul of government quite as radical as this.
I think the Prime Minister was very clear early on that he needed a...
Simply because he goes to this point, along with Esther McVeigh, actually, and Priti Patel, totemic faces that are just associated in the Tory tribe and maybe even in the wider public with Brexit. And so if you've got Rees-Mogg vouching for you, then you have, you know, no question of your Brexit credentials. It's going to make it much harder, for example, for Nigel Farage to attack this government as being insufficiently Brexity, because he loves Rees-Mogg, and Rees-Mogg is actually serving this government. He also, just very practically, who now will coordinate a backbench rebellion against Boris Johnson's government from the right? You know, he's actually brought in the very people who could have given him trouble. Rees-Mogg was there as chair of the European Research Group, that backbench Brexity group. He's now inside the tent rather than outside.
Has he then just reformed Vote Leave? And is that going to be, is that effective campaign team actually going to translate into an effective government?
Maybe not. And that's because running a campaign is very different from running a government. Well, the question is this set up to run an efficient, smooth running administration from now till the scheduled next election in 2022? The answer is probably no. If, however, Boris Johnson isn't playing that game and he's building a campaign team for an early election, then he's got what he wants, and it probably looks quite good. And it was actually this range of appointments which made a whole lot of people, me included, think, ah, so an early election is on. Because what you've got here is not a team to get to make the trains run on time. This is not an efficient government team, really. You know, you've got Michael Gove to do 99 days of preparation for no deal, but overall it doesn't feel like a long-term administration of, you know, steady, solidly efficient people. He fired a whole lot of those types.
How could all of this play out? What are the possible options for Brexit and for the country now?
So there's various scenarios that people are gaming out. One is that this is the so-called lipstick on a pig scenario, which is you take the horrible deal of Theresa May, that's the pig in this analogy, and you put some lipstick on it, you add, with the connivance of Brussels, they have to agree to this, a little bit of cosmetic improvement, you know, a few words here and there that enables Boris Johnson with a straight face to go back to Parliament and say, I've got a whole brand new deal. They'll all know it is still the same pig. Rees-Mogg will know it is, but this time they'll suddenly see new charms in this pig that they didn't see before, and they'll vote for it. And it will go through and will leave by October 31st.
Oh, good, a charming pig.
So that's one scenario, and he's teed that up quite well. The other scenario is that he can't get it through, and therefore he has to exit without a deal, but then Parliament block that. He has a majority of two, and if the Lib Dems win this by-election in Brecon and Radnor next week, it goes down to one. he can't get no deal through. The Gawkward squad, David Gawk and Philip Hammond and all these people he sacked, even Jeremy Hunt, you could imagine, will vote against it, a vote against no deal. And therefore he's blocked. And therefore, what does he do then? He has to then go to the country in an election, in an early election, and says to the country, I wanted to leave. You saw I did. Parliament is blocking me. You've got to give me a new parliament. Now, there was a time where people thought he would wait for the October 31st to come and go for that to happen. I don't think he would do that. Rather, he would go for, and I would put this at least in pencil in your diary, in your calendar. There are a few people, including in the opposition, who think October 24th could be the election.
Why that day?
Because it's a week before the deadline of October the 31st, when we have to leave, and what he could, in law, and what Boris Johnson could do is he could make the whole focus of that campaign, give me the parliament that will enable me to honour the referendum and leave in a week's time. So that literally you elect a new parliament, he gets a majority, and they vote it through a matter of days before the October 31st deadline. Now, there are people who think that will happen. My hunch is that he would rather not do that, because that is to make a next general election a referendum on no deal. And that could be a hard sell. I think his dream scenario is that lipstick on the pig one. He gets the deal through. He's then the man who's done Brexit. He immediately, either switches gear to campaigning. So, as the man who delivered Brexit.
Today, on the stage with me, we have the first, just over 100, of our prospective parliamentary candidates, people who will take the Brexit Party message out to the next general election. Give them a round of applause.
By taking the Tories even further right with this new cabinet, what has this done for the Brexit Party and Farage?
Well, I think it's shot their fox. I mean, I think he has at a stroke, but with the heavy caveat that, of course, he must deliver Brexit from their point of view. He has, burst their balloon, and he's removed from them their whole reason for being, because their premise was Theresa May is dithering. She's really a Remainer. They know that it's delay and extension and it will never happen. So vote for us. And he's now more or less said the same thing. His speech yesterday was British people are sick of indecision. He just, at a stroke, cast the whole last 3 years as sort of one long dither, which is how a lot of people who don't follow the news closely will also see it. So I thought that was effective. And he'll say, I'm going to do it. And if he does, there is no reason for the Brexit Party to exist, and Farage will go off into the sunset. And the impact is, I think, that you then have Leave vote is united. In the next election, it will rally behind him. The Remain vote on the other side remains incredibly divided and split between Lib Dems, Greens, Labour, SNP, Plaid, etc. And that is, I think, how he thinks he can win an election, because one vote is crystallised and solid and one is fragmented.
Jonathan Reardon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can read more from Jonathan Friedland at theguardian.com, and do keep following events from Number 10 on The Guardian's live blog. Coming up, a closer look at this year's Mercury Prize.
I'm Emma John, and I'm sorry. I lied to you.
It's the spin!
I said we'd be happy if England won the World Cup, but lost the Ashes. It's not true. I want it all. I know it's greedy, but positioning the urn next to the World Cup on Ben Stokes' mantelpiece would make this the ultimate summer for English cricket. So join us on The Spin as we turn ourselves into emotional wrecks all over again. It couldn't be as nerve-wracking as the World Cup final, could it?
It's The Spin!
The Spin is supported by NatWest.
Now, the list of nominees for this year's Mercury Prize is out. The Guardian's deputy music editor, Laura Snapes, celebrates a list that seems to hold the spirit of the original prize.
The Mercury Prize is considered really significant because it's supposed to be, you know, the tastemaker prize, what the coolest albums of the UK are that year, what the most kind of defining of our times are, as opposed to the Brits, which is a lot more ruthlessly commercial. Is it still relevant is an interesting question. Probably for the past decade, people have been questioning whether it is. They've picked some really out of touch records at some point. Ed Sheeran was nominated for his past album, which frankly has no place on a list like this. The club isn't the best place to find a lover, so the bar is where I go. But and then also the album has become, you know, less of a thing in people's lives. Our listening is a lot more playlist dominated because of streaming services like Spotify. But this year, they've introduced some new judges, I think, in an attempt to bring some vitality to the prize. Stormzy is one of them, Georgia Smith is another. And I think the majority of those new judges will provide a really crucial counterpoint to what is frankly the very Radio 2 mojo reading kind of mainstay that prop up the rest of the judging panel. You can tell that they're trying to reach out to a younger audience and actually make connections with the role of music in their lives. Usually when critics have looked over that year's Mercury nominees, they're mostly picking out trends in genre, whether it's a good year for bands or a good year for rappers or a good year for jazz. But the interesting thing is there's a lot of political sentiment among these records, and it's not just what we would traditionally consider punk, you know, shouty men with guitars. On one hand, you've got Dave on his album Psychodrama. He's singing about the prison industrial complex. His brother, I think, is inside, and he talks about the deep psychological effects that that has had on him. I remember when you got sentenced and I was throwing up. It's like they took a piece of my freedom when I had opened up. On Foal's new album, they're singing about the torment of the 24-hour news cycle and how that warps our perception of reality. There are similar themes on the 1975's latest album, A Brief Inquiry into Online Relationship.
This is a story about a lonely, lonely man. He lived in a lonely house, on a lonely street, in a lonely part of the world. But of course, he had the internet.
They're talking about how the internet is mediating our life now and the personal chaos that ensues from that.
I said there's nothing great about the place we live in. Nothing great about Britain.
Slow Ties, Nothing Great About Britain starts with him calling the Queen a word that I probably can't say on this podcast. So it's a really striking set of records. It's been maybe a funny year for British music. There's not been so many of the absolutely gigantic banner albums that you might have thought there would be, which is testament to maybe the diminishing of a certain era of superstars and the rise of like a younger wave in their wake. But it was interesting not to see James Blake nominated for his latest album. Florence and the Machine also missed out. Skepta, who won in the past, he'd beat David Bowie's last album to the prize in 2016. But there's nothing spectacularly striking that was missed out. When it shut down, that's not me and it shut down. The bookies' favourite to win at the moment is Dave with Psychodrama, which I reckon that stands a really good chance. I think Idols as well. You know, people like to say that the band is dead these days, but Idols have got a huge fan base, especially if you read below the line on any Guardian article that mentions them. People love Idols. So I think Idols or Dave would be a really good shout. One thing that I've heard from people who have judged in years past is that because of the way they pick the winner, which is on the night, they do it over a dinner, there's a kind of knockout element to it, which means that quite often people's second or third choices are what ends up winning. And I think that can sometimes feel a little bit lackluster and not particularly kind of era-defining in the way that the Mercury people probably would hope it would. So hopefully this injection of young, vital judges will change that a bit.
That's all for today. My thanks to Laura Snapes and to Jonathan Friedland. Today's programme was produced by Rachel Humphreys and Rosie Gillett. The sound design is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back on Monday.